It's my great pleasure to welcome to our little studio Professor Philip Murawski. Now, he's an engaging character, and he completed his doctorate at the University of Michigan with what began as a conventional economic thesis. Over time, he has become increasingly fascinated with why economics thinks of itself as a science, leading to his work in the philosophy of science, and more recently, he's described economists as tone-deaf to history. I like that phrase, tone-deaf to history, and I would have thought that also applies to those who are ardent climate change denialists. And Philip, with one L, picks up a bit where Naomi Klein leaves off, and as you probably know if you've been following Naomi's work of late, she attended the Heartland Institute's 6th International Conference on Climate Change and subsequently wrote about it in The Nation magazine, describing it as the premier gathering for those dedicated to denying the overwhelming scientific consensus that human activity is warming the planet. So that gives us an idea where the Heartland Institute is coming from. But you don't entirely accept this proposition, do you, Philip?
No.
I should point out, I forgot to say this, Philip is the Carl E. Koch, Professor of Economics and History and the Philosophy of Science at the University of Notre Dame in Indiana. And who or what is Carl E. Koch?
He comes from a family of real estate entrepreneurs in Chicago and gave money to the university for my chair.
So it's sort of transmuting base metal into the gold of scholarship.
One hopes.
Excellent. Okay, back to Klein and the Heartland Institute. But you think that simple, if you like, that simple left-wing view isn't good enough?
No, I think that that view goes back a long way, the idea that science is naturally on the side of the left, and in particular that science somehow represents rationality as opposed to the market, which represents rapture or possibly flim-flam and so forth. And Naomi,
so that binary view just doesn't hold up.
That's right, but it's more than that. I think Naomi thinks that what the Heartland people believe is true, that indeed global warming, or science on global warming, will let the left do what it wants to do. In other words, bring in a sort of something like a new kind of socialism. Sometimes they call environmentalists watermelons. They're green on the outside and red on the inside, right? And I think that she misunderstands both what's happening in the science and what's happening in neoliberalism and political economy more generally, so that she doesn't really understand what it is that the neoliberals are trying to do with regard to global warming.
One must remember, of course, and I know Naomi has picked this up, that some of the most catastrophic environmental effects and climate change-inducing problems happened in the old Soviet bloc. In other words, it wasn't axiomatically a problem of capitalism.
That's right. But I do think that the people who now oppose or are denialists think that there are political reasons for opposing the science. And denialism, I think is very important to see, is a short-term policy response on the part of this group.
Short term. In other words, it's a delaying tactic.
Exactly. And what I think people don't understand, and possibly Naomi doesn't understand either, is that this is part of a much larger suite of possible programs to deal with the ways in which the market should respond to global warming.
Well, before we get to that, how do the neoclassical economics and neoliberal economics relate to denialism?
Okay, I know. Neoclassical economics is the orthodox economics that people are taught in the universities right now. And the way neoclassical economics responds to pollution is as a market failure. The problem is not with nature if there's pollution. The problem is with the market. And the way to fix the market is to get it to price the pollution correctly. In essence, you don't fix nature, but you fix the market in the neoclassical view. Neoliberalism, on the other hand, is, I think, the political economy of the modern era, and largely the kind of politics that informs many of the people who are behind denialism. And in neoliberalism, it's a view, a different view of the market, that the market knows more than any human being could ever know. And so therefore, we really have to defer to the market to fix the problems, because we can't understand the problems as well as the market does.
So in their heart of hearts, many of the neoliberals and neoclassical economics people know that it's real. They know the science is kosher, but for political, strategic, tactical reasons, they choose to downplay it.
Right. There's now a fair amount of history that's been done on a number of incidents, like the tobacco strategy, and a number of other.
It greatly
instances.
Resembles tobacco
yes.
denialism, doesn't it?
Exactly. But just as in the case of tobacco, you know, the tobacco industry didn't think they were going to change the science, and we should understand denialism, the climate denialism, in the same way. That really, the purpose of this is to buy time in order to put into place other market responses.
So the Plymouth-Moncton things are merely sideshows?
I think so, although obviously what it does in the short term is it makes it much easier to work people up about resisting other things to do to mitigate climate change. But I think that the real objectives of the neoliberals are to move it into the building of new markets in order to supposedly respond to the problems of climate change.
So another component is to immobilize more carbon abatement through elaborate carbon trading schemes.
Yes. And this, I think, is interesting relative to the left, because the left feels that at least something is being done seriously to mitigate the problem, unlike in the case of denialism. But something that I'd like to point out is that cap-and-trade schemes in particular, selling permits to pollute, actually have failed to reduce carbon emissions almost everywhere that they've been tried. And so I think this is the next stage of the neoliberal response.
You've arrived at a time, of course, when the issue has peaked politically in this country.
Right.
Did you view this with amusement, detachment, irony?
I'm actually a little bit upset, because I think what's happening here is that people are being told in the media that the carbon tax is just a kind of an impermanent way station to the cap and trade scheme, when in fact the cap and trade scheme will probably not, or will not reduce the amount of carbon emissions. For example, in the EU, the permissions prices have crashed twice. And it's been demonstrated by Friends of the Earth and others that the cap has never actually even caused anyone to reduce the emissions, because it was so high that the emissions never reached it in the first place. So in a way, you're being moved from a scheme like the carbon tax, which actually has some hope of reducing emissions, to a different scheme, largely supported by the economists and the neoliberals, that won't.
Now, Amy's book, which I find really quite fascinating, the idea that catastrophe is a great boon to capitalism because it allows the transfer of public funds into private hands. You're not in trying to invalidate that thesis, are you?
Not invalidated. I think the reason why cap and trade is so attractive to some people is because what it does is it creates a situation where the financial sphere can make some money off of these problems, and causes them to make ever more elaborate changes in the rules of trading these permits. And in fact, issues like offsets, where someone plants a tree in Africa and that allows you to buy a permit here. I mean, what that does is that also just makes it so much easier for the more advanced countries to avoid any serious activity having to do with the actual changing of the technologies. And so it's really fascinating, I think, that all the incentives to explore changes are undone by this cap-and-trade scheme, which is supposedly supposed to address climate change.
Is there any significant discussion, or will there be any significant discussion, between Obama and Stormen, the Stormen Mormon, in the presidential election? Or will both of them move away?
Yeah, about this? Yeah. No, I can guarantee you that they are both staying away from this. And what's interesting is when he ran for president last time around, he actually endorsed one of these cap and trade schemes. But ever since then, we haven't heard anything at all about it.
Why is the left so paralyzed on the issue of climate change now?
I think it's because the neoliberals in particular offer a number of different responses to climate change to appeal to these different audiences. I mean, we have the denialism to appeal to people who don't want to change at all. We have cap and trade to appeal, let's say, to the finance sector. And then we have something like geoengineering, you know, putting up space mirrors or, you know, dumping iron in the ocean.
Could be big money for that.
And that's the point, is that, you see, the right also has these kind of science fiction-y responses, whereas the left, most of the time, what the left does is just sort of say, well, you know, you have to put on the hair shirt and that's it.
Well, of course, it's worked, hasn't it? Last year's annual Lowy Institute poll, Lowy being a progressive think tank in the Australian context, showed a steep fall in the number of Australians who believe that climate change is a serious problem that needs immediate attention. The number of respondents wanting to see action on climate change has fallen 27 percentage points over the last 5 years. In the US, your country, polling found that in 2007, 73% of Americans believed that climate change was caused by continued combustion of fossil fuels. Now, or by 2011, that percentage had dropped to 41%. So the enemies of science, if you like, are being much more successful.
I think what is going on here is that the, particularly the neoliberals, see the problem as one of knowledge, and it happens at many different levels. It's what kind of knowledge can the general public have? What sort of knowledge would the traders have of the cap and trade scheme? What sort of knowledge would the scientists have? And they are willing to develop multiple policies to appeal to those different groups. And as far as I can tell, on my experiences on the left, is that there's a sense that somehow the science is on our side and everything else should follow. And I think what geoengineering shows is that there are neoliberal scientists as well who think that somehow entrepreneurial activity will save us.
Well, that comes back to your point that science is not axiomatically of the left.
That's correct.
As weapon systems developers remind us, if you look at the conflict intellectually, morally, ethically over the development of nuclear weapons.
But I think in this case it is a little different, because there's a sense that of what can be known and what can't be known. I think the neoliberals really think that no person can know how to really adjust to climate change. No person at all, no politician, nobody. Only the market can really come to an accommodation with big global changes like that. And see, I detect
a certain sympathy for this?
No, not at all. What I'm trying to get across is that I encounter people on the left all the time who think that we have to have some kind of accommodation to one of these in order to succeed. And I think the problem is deeper than that. I think that the left has to have a different story of what markets do and what their relationship is to knowledge. But
that sort of energy is happening in other parts of the United States, even if it manifests itself in something as naive as the Occupy movement. There are people trying to get out different narratives.
Right, but I don't hear a different narrative about what we're supposed to do about global climate change, though, coming out of the Occupy movement. I think they know that it's a problem, but I don't think that they have thought very hard about the ways in which each of these moves make it possible for there not to be any serious diminution of CO2 emissions.
I think the left is, as you say, hair shirt and let's live more pious and appropriate lives. And they would certainly be opposed to, to geoengineering solutions to the big umbrellas, or, you know, whacking stuff up in the layers. That, I think, is seen as absolutely not on.
I don't know. I've had some experiences lately, especially with regard to this this spice experiment, where they send up a balloon in order to spray aerosols into the upper stratosphere in order to increase the reflectivity of the Earth.
Yeah. They've actually done experiments on this?
Well, that's interesting, too, is that it was a planned experiment in Britain out of Cambridge University, a couple of other places. And a number of some people on the left, you were right, did try to organize to stop it. were totally incapable of stopping it. And the only thing that stopped it was that two of the members of the group went out without telling the other members and tried to get patents on the thing.
Oh, dear.
And so everyone got mad at each other, and the experiment fell apart. But that doesn't mean it won't happen again. See, I think what's going on here is that science itself is being changed by commercialization. And that's one of the problems with Naomi's position.
Okay, talk to that. Science is being changed by commercial.
The difference is, it used to be that there was this kind of sense that science, while not totally separate from its applications, could be developed, at least initially, separate from its applications, and that as universities are under...
Well, that disappeared stress. During the Cold War in the United States.
Well, it certainly disappeared by now. And I think now people seem to be proud that somehow this is going to get more technological change out the door or something like that. But what they don't realize is it's changing the nature of the science itself. That is, I think a science that thought of itself as operating in the public interest might hesitate to do things like spew sulfur dioxide into the stratosphere. But here, there are people who are betting on the possibility that some corporation could make money from it in the future.
So cap and trade or carbon trading doesn't work at ameliorating global warming.
Right.
You say primarily because it was never really intended to do so.
I think.
So the final neoliberal fallback is geoengineering. But that's very much an admission of defeat, that you go to that final solution early.
Only if you think that people were supposed to organize the response to global warming. But see, deep down, the neoliberals don't think we know enough to organize the response. The only correct response, in their view, are some entrepreneurs trying strange, out-of-the-box experiments like this. And somehow the market will find the truth in the end.
And you don't think that mere politics can stop in geoengineering going forward, do you?
Not unless it was really the kind of politics that would be willing to organize whole groups of scientists across nations. And I don't think even the scientists who worry about global warming probably would feel nervous about that.
Of course, not even neoliberalism is monolithic. There must be conflicts within the...
But I think we were already talking about them. I mean, it doesn't sound like denialism conflicts with geoengineering. You see, the whole point of it is that this is not a single lockstep group that, you know, marches to a, you know, the same drummer and so forth. That both denialism and geoengineering are supported out of neoliberal think tanks, and sometimes out of the same neoliberal think tanks, which is very interesting, I think. You see, these guys know how to place bets on both the short term, which is, you know, stop carbon tax now, let's say, and the long term, that we are going to solve this problem by issuing intellectual property against this kind of new science.
But you do acknowledge that there is a great truth in the far right, who mightn't be as sophisticated as the people we're talking about, seeing the whole thing as a left-wing plot, as another way of achieving left-wing ambitions.
Well, what I've been doing all along here is arguing against that, because what's happening with regard to the science is that the science doesn't necessarily tell us that, I mean, all scientists don't necessarily tell us that what we should reduce carbon emissions. The geoengineers actually are saying, well, look, people won't do it, yeah, so let's do something else.
It's a fact of life. So
yes, exactly.
We're going to do a repair job rather than a preventive job.
Exactly. That's right. See, so science doesn't go in any one particular way. And I think the politics of this don't go in any one particular way either.
But you and I have agreed that we see echoes in what we're witnessing now on climate change science and denialism with what we witnessed a generation ago when Philip Morris and Big Tobacco fought a battle to the death, literally, on cigarettes.
Very much so. And matter of fact, I've noticed that coming from the United States to Australia, that what has happened here is this whole tobacco strategy being rolled out in the same way that it was rolled out 10 years ago in the United States.
Well, I was involved in the anti-smoking campaign. I used to do a fair bit of work with the Anti-Cancer Council, now for some reason known as the Cancer Council. They dropped the anti. But, the argument then was pretty simple, that there were a whole thing, a lot of things you could do. You could change people's attitudes through propaganda, but you could in effect have a cap and trade system by increasing the cost of cigarettes again and again and again. And now, to some extent, the left-wing view on the current crisis is that the world's got to give up smoking through via smokestacks in the way that they had to give up smoking
vapes. I think that's right, that there has to be a change in the technologies of energy production so that so much carbon is not being emitted into the air. But I think it has to be done consciously. It can't be done indirectly through the market.
Yeah. Who's winning over there?
Oh, I think there's no doubt that it's not even possible to have a serious discussion of carbon abatement in the United States right now in the political sphere.
Not absolutely out of the question.
No one takes.
And just as all the Republican candidates told us that we'd have to take guns out of their cold, dead hands, and just as they all said that evolution is nonsense, they're all saying basically that the human component in climate change is just a furphy.
That's what they say. I think they all know that there is a problem. But the issue is, I think they also believe something like the neoliberals, strangely enough, that somehow the market is going to fix it so that we don't have to address it politically. I think I run into that attitude a lot.
And are you also observing Steve Jobs leaping, you know, people like the sainted Steve, leaping into the fray?
There are very few entrepreneurs who are willing to speak publicly about what needs to be done in the United States. I don't get that.
If they're winning, if they're on the side of, if they see themselves as being on the side of history, why not?
Why not? That's a really hard question. I mean, Naomi Oreskes once said that, look, the reason why cap and trade worked with sulfur dioxide was that, I think it was Dow Chemical, just decided that, look, we could adjust to this, you know, getting rid of these CFCs, and so we'll go along with some kind of program to ameliorate them. See, but there's no break in the capitalist front like Dow breaking away with sulfur dioxide. There's no, when it comes to carbon dioxide.
What if you look further afield? What if you look to Europe? What if you look to China? What if you look to...
Well, see, I think the difference is there that there is much more of an emission in Europe because they have the trading scheme. But, of course, the sting in the tail comes that the trading scheme has not reduced emissions in Europe, even though, you know, you can trade a lot of... you can trade a lot of permits. And in fact, the permit trading has crashed twice in the last decade. The prices of the permits have crashed twice in Europe. And no one seems to realize that maybe this is a structural flaw in this particular approach.
My guest has been Philip with one L, Mariski, who's the Carly Koch Professor of Economics and History and Philosophy of Science at the University of Notre Dame in Indiana. He's here in Australia as Distinguished Visiting Professor, God, I love academic titles, at the University of Technology, Sydney, and he's giving two public lectures this week, and we'll put details of those and details of Philip's books on our website at abc.net.au/radionational and follow the prompts to Late Night Live. Now, Philip, I want you to stick around because I'm going to sell you a superannuation policy. This is a great Australian achievement. L&L on RN.